Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
And we have got to turn our attention south again, Rosie. On Tuesday, former police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted on all three counts, including murder and manslaughter, for killing George Floyd. I'd like to talk about what this verdict changes. Does it change anything when it comes to policing? And what does it mean going forward?
Meanwhile, Ontario is in the throes of a full-blown COVID crisis. The premier's own science advisors are taking their gloves off during interviews, explaining why they think Doug Ford has failed so badly. There have been promises of more federal help, but many in the province are still wondering if Ontario can't or won't take the necessary measures to contain this. Where do they turn?
Are you saying Ontario needs a hero? Is that what you're saying?
All right, let's do it.
Rosie, we are recording this a day after Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all counts. He is the officer who was charged with killing. Well, I guess we don't have to say killing. Like, he's now the officer who murdered George Floyd last May. In the wake of that murder, protests erupted across the world. You know, every city in the U.S., here in Canada, in so many other countries. It was like this explosion of outcry because everyone saw that viral video, that really vicious, upsetting, cruel viral video where Chauvin kneeled on George Floyd and basically just waited until he died. And honestly, with respect to this verdict of finding Chauvin guilty, it's been a hard story to process. I've been trying to locate where I'm at with processing this news, because I remember when the push alert came through on Tuesday afternoon, and I found out that he was guilty. And initially, I felt this wave of relief, you know. And then I read a lot of other people's reactions, and they were in disbelief. And I was trying to like figure out what this disbelief is. Like, we all saw Chauvin kill George Floyd. We heard it in the video. We saw George Floyd cry for his mother, and then like his body just stopped moving. We all saw a murder in that video. So why was there this like widespread disbelief that a court said the murder we saw was in fact a murder? That's what I was trying to process. And I feel like that's where I want to start, you know, with this idea that, yeah, we all saw a police officer kill a man and then waited for a court to say, yes, this really was murder. And to some extent, people were bracing for the opposite. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, I felt the same concern that in spite of that video that documented what unfolded, that somehow it still wouldn't be enough. But it was. We should say that today as well, on the day we're recording this, the Justice Department in Minneapolis says that they will now investigate police and operations of Minneapolis, the whole police department, to see whether there's a pattern or a practice of unlawful policing. So that's something that has already happened a day later as a direct result of this verdict. And I guess a few things as I watched people, I don't know, celebrate is sort of the wrong word, but there was some of that in the streets in the United States, and I'm sure some people were here as well. I guess I was wondering, what does this change? And I ask that because this just seems to me like, yes, it's a turning point that a police officer was convicted, charged and convicted. But also, what does it mean going forward when we've already had, you know, as that trial was going on, the killing of another black man, Dante Wright, who was in his car, and the police officer says she fired a taser. In fact, it was her gun. She has now also been charged. I guess I'm a bit lost in terms of how significant this is and what it will actually lead to, or what it needs to lead to, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to say that this was a victory, you know, but like when you look closer at it, it doesn't feel like one. And maybe the reason it doesn't feel like one is that it took a lot of bending of the truth to get there. Like, I was following this trial really closely, so I was paying attention to the specific arguments that the prosecutors were making in saying that Chauvin was guilty. And they were not making the argument that this man is a murderer. Like, it went beyond that. The core of their argument, and I watch this every day, the core of the argument that the prosecution made is that policing is this noble profession, and Chauvin betrayed its ideals. And this is a tidy story, but it is just not that simple. Like, the Washington Post has been keeping track of all civilians killed by police since 2015, and they've been finding out that, on average, police in the U.S. kill about 1,000 people a year. And investigations rarely turn into charges, and if they do, about 5% of those charged will end up being actually convicted. And, like, those numbers are in conversation with the numbers here in Canada. Last July, CP reported that less than 10% of police watchdog investigations in Canada end up in charges against police officers. And at the CBC, we did an investigation that looked at the data long-term between 2000 and 2018. And in that period of time, 461 people died in an encounter with police. Criminal charges were laid against 18. Two officers were convicted. So I think about those numbers, and I think about Constable Daniel Montsian, who was found not guilty last year in any of the charges related to the death of Abdurrahman Abdi. And I think folks remember Abdi's story. He was a black man killed in Ottawa, killed by police, despite witnesses saying he was, like, very obviously in mental distress. And so I think about all of these things and think about this fiction that policing is this noble profession instead of one that is obviously in need of reevaluation in order to get Chauvin convicted. And I just don't know what to do with that. Like, I don't even know if I can count that as a victory.
Yeah, I'm going to do something. I'm going to quote Amanda Gorman, who, you know, the poet laureate for the U.S., who yesterday just tweeted on Instagram something that to me really rang true. She tweeted this: a reminder that victory would be George Floyd being alive. Everyday Black Americans worry if they will be next is another day without justice. So, like, that speaks to your point, right? There's a difference between accountability and justice. There's a difference between a verdict and victory. There's a difference between what happened and Black Americans feeling safe. And those things haven't changed even after what happened yesterday with the verdict. And I guess that's sort of what you start to think about, what has to happen in terms of law enforcement or legislation or Congress making changes. There are some U.S. states that after this happened started to put in place various law enforcement reform bills around the, for instance, the no-knock technique that would allow police to barge into your home without having to knock the door. That is what led to the killing of Breonna Taylor, for instance. But at the same time, there's other states in the U.S. where they're looking for ways to clamp down on public protests, which is how a lot of people found a way to speak out after the murder of George Floyd. It does, for me, because I am of a certain age, really harken back to, though, the first time that I saw police brutality of this kind on TV, and it was 30 years ago when Rodney King was brutally assaulted by LA police, police officers in Los Angeles. Even at that time, although police officers were charged, four of them were acquitted of the charges. Three of those police officers who were acquitted were white. And so if you look, like, if you take that point to where we are now, something has changed, obviously. Something has evolved. Yeah. But God, that took a long time, right? That took a long time. And so what is the next change that is needed? And it has to be that police do not respond to Black people or people of color in this way that leads to this instance. And I'm not talking about all police. I understand that. But too often that the response is violence, is meeting people of color with violence.
And I think about maybe the easier way to think about this is in terms of relationship to the police and what we expect the police to do. And I know we're going to talk about Ontario in just a minute, but one story from this past week was that Ontario was going to expand the powers of cops to do more. The idea was that they're going to have the right to stop people and ask what they're doing out of their house. And I saw that story and my heart sank because I knew that this, like any other sort of enhanced police power, ends up affecting people of color more. And it made me really anxious, honestly. There was ended up being quite a bit of backlash against that idea, and they ended up rolling it back. But then 2 days later, BC Premier John Horgan said that BC will be starting to do random checks, and they walked that back too. But I was like, do you guys just like not get Ontario news? Like that just did not play out very well. But the grander point is this, is that, you know, a year ago, we heard politicians say that something has to change. Something has to change about the role we expect police to play in our lives. And in the wake of this verdict, we heard Joe Biden say, you know, this verdict is not enough. Trudeau spoke about how we still have a long way to go. But then when you have premiers of different political stripes, I should say, not even thinking twice, but saying, oh, no, the police is the right way to go to deliver this message that people should stay home. It's like, did anyone do any of the thinking that was asked of them in terms of the role of police? Did anyone hear the outcries of last year? Because I feel like the answer is no.
Hi, I'm Damon Fairless, host of Hunting Warhead from CBC Podcasts and the Norwegian newspaper VG. Hunting Warhead follows a global team of police and journalists as they attempt to dismantle a massive network of predators on the dark web. Winner of the grand prize for best investigative reporting at the New York festivals and recommended by The Guardian, Vulture, and The Globe and Mail, you can find Hunting Warhead on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So without revealing my home address, I will tell you that I am relatively close to a place where on Monday, Ottawa police started setting up to check people coming across the border from Gatineau into Ottawa. This followed the Ford government's decision that they wanted to start limiting who was coming, who was flocking to Ontario through various border points between Quebec and Ontario and Manitoba and Ontario. So as I walk the dog, because I will admit to walking the dog, I was something I was allowed to do. Down the street, I would see the police officers sort of say, roll down your window, ask, are you going to work? The person would say yes. Sometimes they would hold up a piece of paper, sometimes they wouldn't, and then they would go on their way. So that was Monday. We're recording this on Wednesday. There are no longer any police officers down by my house. There are no police officers on the street pulling people over because the Ottawa police have decided that that was enough, that they had done what the premier had asked them to do. They had educated people and caused traffic jams for 2 days, and and they were pretty much done with that. And it is, I tell this anecdote because it is indicative, I think, of bigger thing happening in this province at a moment of crisis. And that is people, citizens, medical experts, police, pockets of individuals pushing back against a government that seems, I'm going to be kind here, seems confused or unwilling to take advice or seems to be struggling with what to do. I'll give you one more example and then I'll let you talk. The Ontario Science Table. So this is a panel of experts who are giving free advice, independent advice to the government about how they should respond and measures they should take around the pandemic. This week, they released some of their advice because the Ford government decided that they were going to shut down all these outdoor activities in the province, from golf to tennis to baseball diamonds to basketball, hoops, everything. And the Science Table then went public, and Dr. Peter Uni, who's the scientific director of the Ontario Science Table, says, listen, we didn't recommend this at all because we know that being outside is important. We know that being outside, the exposure to COVID is much greater. And I'm going to quote this quote from Dr. Peter Uni, who said this, I don't think we can be any clearer. This is a problem at the receiving end.
First of all, let me start by saying the hardest part to believe of all of that was that people are trying to come into Ontario. I find that impossible to imagine at the moment. What are you doing here? Why would you want to come into this place? Let me say it like this. Yeah. I think it was overwhelming and frankly kind of destabilizing to watch the decision tree in Ontario suddenly collapse this past week. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I got to mention that on Friday we had two press conferences. One was where the modelers told us that here's what we need to know. We need to know that things are going to be really bad by the end of May. If Ontario doesn't begin to implement certain measures, and here's what we need to avert it. And he's like, really bad. Like, we're talking like 18,000 cases a day bad. Like, that was sort of what the model was predicting, and outlined some steps for how to get there. And then the second press conference was one where people waited for Premier Doug Ford to announce those measures. And he did not. Instead, he announced things like playgrounds are closing. And honestly, like, about 9 different people I know watched that press conference in disbelief, and they cried, and it was the first time any of them cried watching a political press conference, because normally those things are like not that interesting. But to find yourself in tears after watching that press conference, I think is quite telling. So when I think about that outcome, and I think about it, becomes kind of clear why they cried, you know, because in response to all the measures they rolled out, people immediately said, what is the science? What is the science behind closing playgrounds while schools are closed? And then they walked that back. Police units, like you mentioned, across the province said, no, we are not doing these random checks. And they walked that back. Businesses with outbreaks were not order closed. So then Peel Region and Toronto, those health units said, you know what? If you're a workplace and you've had more than 5 cases in the last 2 weeks, then you're going to have to shut down for a certain number of days. In other words, there's a feeling that whoever was in control was no longer in control anymore, because all these other parts of the decision tree, the police officers, the local public health units, they were taking it upon themselves to make the right decisions. And Paul Wells from McLean's called that Ford presser the worst he's ever seen. And that guy's seen like roughly 5 million pressers over his career. So I take him at his word when he sort of puts it at that level. Like, I heard perfectly reasonable people muse about things like, can the federal government invoke the Emergencies Act here? That's where we're at. Like, this is the level of mess and disaster that we're in right now.
Yeah, I will, as a journalist, not hesitate to characterize this as a governing by chaos. I do not think that you can provide the leadership required when you are pushing forward, as you point out, ideas and suggestions and recommendations that do not appear to be based on the evidence you have been presented with. And then when you have to rely on a bunch of sort of local decision makers or people lower on the organizational chart to refuse to invoke those things or to make their own decisions to try and force the government's hand, that does not inspire an enormous amount of confidence, which is something mm-hmm. that people really need to feel right now. I'll say 2 things. One about the Emergencies Act. First of all, the federal government has been and continues to be loath to get to that point. They want to be viewed as collaborative as possible. They do not want to go in with a heavy hand on anyone to enforce it. But the second thing I would point out is the Emergencies Act is also a legal device. And so they would have to be able to show that the province of Ontario cannot provide what is required to help with a public health emergency. Not that it's choosing not to provide, that it doesn't mm-hmm. have what it takes to do it. And that's the fundamental difference right now. The federal government obviously, too, feels some frustration with what's unfolding in Ontario. At the end of last week, they made a couple of offers to help, to which Doug Ford's government said, oh, no, we didn't ask for help and we don't want that. It led then a handful of ministers to emerge on a rare Sunday to say we've spent the weekend coming up with ways to help Ontario, even if they don't want it, which include things like we'll pay airfare for nurses that PEI can send in order to help Ontario, because that's where we're at, that the smallest province has to help the biggest one. We'll pay for that airfare if that's all if that's all we can do without Ontario having to actually ask for and receive the help. This is a little bit of what the Prime Minister had to say about that on Tuesday.
We are looking across the federal government for help that we can send directly to Ontario. Provinces have stepped up. I spoke with a number of them over the weekend, and we're now working on the details and logistics of that. And as well, we are directing more rapid tests, as we said, among other things, to the provinces. We are not yet at the point of being able to make an announcement, but I can assure you that people are working day and night on establishing what the best way is to help. What Ontarians and indeed all Canadians need to know is that the federal government will continue to be there to support the people of Ontario, to support people right across the country as we make it through this third wave.
I want to be clear. This is not about beating up, Ontario or Doug Ford's government. This is really about showing in a really, I think, honest way that good advice has been provided, good evidence has been provided, and the government has chosen to not make decisions based on that, and then has to flip-flop and reverse itself in a matter of sometimes hours in order to address the concerns of citizens and public health officials. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is something to the idea that, you know, even if it might not be necessarily legal right now to invoke the Emergencies Act, just merely musing about the legality of it, I think, like, tells us a little bit about the scope of the crisis that we're talking about. And we'll add one more dimension of this, which is that the Ontario government has been under pressure for literally months. Like, I remember the first op-ed that I read about this was way back in September to launch a provincial sick leave program to supplement the federal program that the Liberals rolled out. This is something that the Premier has been getting questions on nearly every week. Now they are saying that they are considering it. It's something that they are thinking about, but they're framing it in the context of saying, well, we saw the federal budget and it seems like the Liberals are not going to increase what they're offering, so therefore we're going to roll out our own. It does feel like it's way too late. Like, everybody's been asking for this for a long time. Experts have said that if we had a provincial sick leave program that could supplement what the federal program gives right now, then we would not be in the situation that we're in. But we are months and months and months, 13 months into this pandemic. We've been hearing this particular note for so long, and it must feel disorienting if you are these experts who are providing advice, whether you're at the science advisory table or at any other level of expertise, and saying, this is a policy you need now to fix this, and then consistently having them say, we're going to do something else, or not do the thing that you just recommended. I think we learned a few things this week, and one of them is that in the face of all these systems, eventually there is a point where this province will respond to all these fronts demanding change. But it has taken them this long, and the main takeaway here is that nobody can force the government to act if they don't want to, and so everyone is just waiting for them to act.
Let me just end by saying that on the day that we are recording this, Doug Ford is self-isolating because a member of his staff tested positive for COVID. The premier has tested negative, but Premier Ford is staying home from work and working from home because that is the best public health advice. But that's something that he is able to do. That's the sound of the five-year-olds in Ontario at the playground. Now that they're open again. Okay, they're like juice boxes. It's juice boxes.
Yes, they're clicking juice boxes. Makes perfect sense.
It's also the sound of last call. Last week we asked you, do you feel your government is holding up its end of the pandemic bargain? Whether that's the federal government, provincial government, municipal government. This one really, like, that whole podcast resonated with people, but the question did too, Alamine.
Yes, people had really strong feelings about this, and I just, every time that there are strong feelings, I love it. I'm here for it. So here's what we heard. A listener in Calgary wrote, the Alberta government has not held up its end of the bargain. Aloha, anyone? From attacking doctors to disobeying their own public health guidelines, Jason Kenney's United Conservative Party has embarrassed and let down our province. And then one person in Toronto wrote, No, I don't think the Ontario government has held up their side of the bargain. The Ontario government's combination of you're allowed to do X, Y, Z, but we don't want you to is just as utterly silly as their absolute refusal to consider paid sick leave. Of course, we're possibly seeing a reversal of that on this last point, but we don't know yet. We'll see what happens there.
Someone in Winnipeg wrote, perhaps this new spell of COVID frustration we're seeing across Canada has to do with how badly the vaccine rollout has been from coast to coast. Politicians tightening the ropes is tough to stomach after constant fumbling. Another person in Alberta also said this, here in Calgary, numbers are really high, and yet people are still able to eat on patios, they're packed, and teachers have been told they can't get vaccinated yet. I am one who is desperate to get vaccinated ASAP.
I do not understand people who are eating at patios right now. If you are doing so, tweet me. Just explain to me what you're thinking.
What's
I'd like to know.
What's going on there? Yeah.
Genuinely. And then lastly, some perspective from the Maritimes. This person wrote, here in New Brunswick, I am pleased with how the government... I'm pleased.
Oh, it's New Brunswick, though.
I'm pleased. I know. Yeah. Well, I love this for you. I love this for you. Yeah. So here's what they wrote. Here in New Brunswick, I'm pleased with how the government has handled our cases. I strongly dislike the restrictions, but understand why they need to happen. I'm disappointed in the vaccine rollout, though. In the beginning, the government had the capacity to vaccinate huge numbers of people, but blamed the federal government on supply issues. Now the vaccines are here, and we're vaccinating at a rate far less than they originally claimed we could do if we had the supply.
Fair to say, though, no one's really happy. Like a little bit of like, I'm pleased, but no one's happy with anything.
That's fair. That's fair.
It's a lot. This week, we want to ask, though, about the first topic we discussed on the podcast. Do you think that Derek Chauvin's conviction in the murder of George Floyd will move the needle on racial justice in policing? You can tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is PartyLines and let us know what you think.
And that is it for PartyLines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdelmahmoud, Chief Juicebox Correspondent and Culture Writer for BuzzFeed News.
I love a Five Alive. I love a Five Alive. See you next week.
You bet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.